Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Blog Talk Radio and the Powerful Patient. We're certainly glad that you've joined us today. We have a very exciting opportunity to sit down and talk with Joyce and with Robin as we discuss something that took place recently. The International Kidney Cancer Coalition's annual conference from Mexico City, Mexico. And we had quite a number of patient organizations there. As a matter of fact, we had 25 from all six continents. Had the penguins been able to catch their flight, we would have probably had representatives from all seven continents. And Robin, I'm going to bring you up first. We're going to have a good conversation between you and Joyce in just a few minutes, but you know, Joyce retired after 6 years serving on the board of directors of the IKCC, and now she's taken on the role of IKCC Board Senior Emeritus, and she'll remain a valued representative of the IKCC affiliate organization Powerful Patient and serve on the IKCC Nominations Committee. So we've got a celebrity in our midst, Robin. So how do you feel about that?
We must defer and be more respectful.
Yes, that's something I have to do, I guess.
That's right, Mike. We're going to be watching you real close. it was a wonderful experience, of course, again, to be at IKCC. Everybody there is just so eager to do as much as they can for patients and to learn more about what they can do. And the projects, both from the affiliate organizations and from IKCC itself, are getting bigger and stronger and better every year. It's a delight to watch this organization grow and to be a part of it and to be able to offer some round services to it. So it was just a thrilling conference overall, 3 days jam-packed with meetings and networking and trying to get some rest in between. Anyway, it was great. So, Joyce, what do you have to say?
Well, thank you both. And Mexico City was lovely. People said, oh, did you get to tour Mexico City? And I think I had 2 hours for touring in a week in the city. But it is a beautiful city, and their anthropological museum is incredible. Talks about the Aztecs and the other peoples that were there before Columbus. The conference, as always, as you said, is wonderful because we bring together organizations that support people with kidney cancer. And a lot of the content is about treatment of kidney cancer itself, but a lot of the content is really quite general to supporting almost any disease and how the strategies for how to do that, not just in the developed countries like Europe and North America, but also in the developing countries or the resource-limited countries around the world. And many of them are trying to do health care for all. And, of course, that's a big expense item, particularly because kidney cancer in particular and many cancers are being diagnosed when they're already stages 3 and 4. And once a cancer is at stages 3 and 4, it's an expensive course to try to do something and fix it. So one of the big challenges in that world is to bring the diagnosis earlier in the process. And we do see that happening in the West. So in Europe and in North America, Canada and the U.S., we see that more and more cancers are being identified at stages 1 and 2, when they're tiny little tumors, sometimes you can just take out the tumor and that's the end of the story. Sometimes there's a little follow-up radiation and chemo, but the treatment is relatively short-lived and successful. But when it's stages 3 and 4, it's a much different game.
You're right. It becomes much more resource intensive as soon as it becomes locally advanced or metastatic.
Right.
And the difficulty, of course, in many countries is that they don't have equipment to diagnose early. And if a person doesn't have some kind of problem that causes them to have an ultrasound or a scan, there's really very little hope for early diagnosis at this point. And that's one reason why research is looking for an early type of either blood or urine test that could detect that there's a cancer problem developing.
Right. We had two really excellent keynote speakers at this meeting. Dr. Felicia Knoll, who is at the University of Miami, talked about closing the cancer divide, that rich people or people in developed nations have a much greater chance of surviving a larger stage kidney cancer. Like our dear friend Mike here is a 20-year survivor with metastatic kidney cancer. That would be very hard to pull off in India or Korea or Nigeria or any of the more resource-limited countries. Both because you might not have access to the medications and also that the government might not be willing to pay for those medications that it takes to pull that off. So how do we close that cancer divide? And what she was saying is that it's important that we do it to save the lives of our citizens who could be very strong contributing members of the society if they didn't die early of cancer. And also because we need to pay attention to all of our citizens, and everybody is worthy of that kind of intention, that we need to work with the patients to get evidence-based information from the patients as well as from the doctors. And we talked a lot through the conference about how we can use the power of bringing the patients together to learn from the patients what their earliest symptoms were. Maybe there's something that we're not paying attention to that could be an early sign of these diseases, and work from there. And also working with the doctors to find better, easier, cheaper solutions to the more advanced issues.
One of the things that I noticed that was really significant was the work that the Korean Cancer Care Alliance has done. Korea has about 55 million patients, I think, population. And kidney cancer is their 10th most common cancer. With the advent of westernized eating, there's...
We've got some crosstalk on the line. I don't know.
You're breaking up, Mike.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. Let's see if we got rid of the crosstalk now.
Sounds better.
Okay, we'll get to censor that one out. We've added a few extra minutes to edit.
No problem.
So one of the things that really impressed me and that stood out to me was the work that the Korean Cancer Care Alliance is doing. They represent about 52 million people in Korea. And kidney cancer is the 10th most common cancer in occurrence and diagnosis. And as they begin to practice westernized eating habits and increase their salty food, and begin to increase their stress level, it seems like the cancer is increasing. But one of the challenges that they face, as you were already talking about, is low access to drugs. There's only 4 approved medications in the first line, but only one of those are reimbursed by the government. The other 3 are completely out of pocket. I think the government pays like 5% of the cost, and the patient has to come up with 95% of the cost of treatment. Same way about the most frequently used surgery there, which is robotic surgery. That's not a reimbursable thing either. The patient has to come up with 95% of the cost of that. So it's a real challenge in some of these countries to receive this care unless you happen to have access to a lot of finances.
Wow. You know, if that happened all over the world, it would be really frightening because it's so expensive to treat advanced cancer, and there would be people scrambling everywhere to get money to save their loved ones.
Well, that's exactly right. I know of a family, you know, they were participants in the IKCC, but I know of a family in the Philippines. He passed away in 2012. The family is still paying for his medical expenses. And one of the sisters lives in Singapore, one lives in the Philippines, and the family are still financially strapped trying to pay for his treatments that he received. And they told me not too long ago it's going to take another 3 years to pay those bills off.
Right, and we've all seen some patients in some countries go on television to raise money or go on the internet for crowdfunding. It happens in the U.S. as well when people can't afford their treatment, and it's really a shame that it comes to that. I think that's why I'm looking to work two ends of the spectrum. Not only do we need to have better, cheaper, more accessible care for people with advanced cancers, but somehow we need to move that spectrum down more. If we were treating early stage cancers, it's much more likely to be successful and for less money. So how can we do that? And as Robin said, we need those biomarkers or like a dipstick test. When you go to the doctor, if you could do one of those dipstick tests in your urine and say, I think we'd better do a CAT scan and see what's going on your kidney. That would be a blessing for everybody. We don't have that yet, but how can we achieve it? And the other keynote speaker that we had was a Dr. Brenda Galley from the Hospital for Sick Kids in Toronto, and she heads up the retinoblastoma program there. And what she's done, retinoblastoma is a rare cancer that affects the eye in children, and it's usually fatal, has been usually fatal, and she's working to try to reduce the number of fatalities to 0. And the way she's working at it is to create a database of all the patients with retinoblastoma in the world and get input not only from their doctors, but also from the patients and the parents so that they really capture the whole experience of this disease. And they're working away at how can we improve the experience, how can we make the treatment more successful and reduce the number of fatalities from this disease. So to me, that's one good demonstration of the power of the patients being together, that the patients have a lot to contribute to research. And we're not always acknowledged by the researchers, but once they discover us, and then usually they're very excited about the contributions of the patients.
And having the input from the patients can help people say, this treatment sounds really scary to me, but I see examples here and here and here and here of people who've had that treatment, and they came through it, and
right.
they're doing well now. So if you suggest that treatment to me, or if I suggest that treatment to you, I'm not as frightened of it as I would be if I didn't know anything about it.
Right. The first time you hear
That's...
about a new treatment, it's usually pretty scary. But once you've heard a success story or two, you go, okay, I think I could manage this. I'll give it a try. It really instills some hope. Mike, you were going to say something?
Yeah, that's something that I see a lot of patients really get concerned about, because they'll pick up the label for that particular medication, and they'll start reading for all the possible side effects and the black box warnings and everything. And in many cases, they will never encounter those situations. But it really causes concern if they access that without somebody giving them some insight that, wait a minute, you're probably not going to experience all of the above.
Yeah, it reminds me of when my son had his first surgery when he was 15 years old. The anesthesia people come in and they start reading all the list of horrible things that could go wrong with you, including death, right? And so here's my 15-year-old, and I watched him blanch. His face got whiter and whiter as the list went on. So finally I turned to the anesthesiologist and I said, okay, that's the list of all the possibles, but for a 15-year-old boy in good health, what's the chance that any of those things are going to happen to him? He said, oh, way under 5%. And suddenly my son began to pink up again. It's like, oh, okay, I think I can handle this. But you're right. We have to put it in context. And that list is very real. It's important to read it and to know about it, but also to put it in proportion.
Right. You don't want to be blindsided by one of those odd things that might happen, but you also don't want to be terrified that something with a 1% chance is going to happen to you. So, Joyce, for the record, how old is your son now?
My son is 47.
So that's a fantastic record of survival, and he's doing pretty well with his life?
Yes, he is. Thank you. Yeah, he still has a good quality of life. And he has von Hippel-Lindau disease, so he's been down a bumpy road with that. And VHL is the leading genetic cause of kidney cancer. There are some kidney cancers that run in the family, and VHL is the biggest of those. There are several others as well. And for people who have kidney cancer in the family, we have a sort of early warning sign that nobody else has right now, because we have a DNA test for our particular genetic causes, and we can say, oh, this person has VHL, then in his lifetime, he has a 60% chance, not a 6% chance, but a 60% chance of having kidney cancer. So we know to watch out for it. So that, in a sense, it's a blessing, having one of these lovely conditions, because we do get that early warning sign that the general population doesn't have. And somehow we have to get an early warning sign for the general population that would work.
And something that would just be routine when you go to the doctor's office and they do a blood draw or they take a urine sample, that they would just look at it and check you out.
Right, that would be the cheapest and most accessible. Or my favorite one is, if you ever watched Star Trek The Return, where they had to, it's a movie where they had to go back and get a whale from the 20th century to save the universe. And at one point, one of their guys is injured, and they take him to a 20th century hospital. And Dr. McCoy is horrified. Oh, my God, they've taken him to this Neanderthal hospital, you know. So they go to rescue their guy from this 20th century hospital, and he's walking down the corridor, and there's a woman on a gurney in the corridor, and she's going, oh, I'm on dialysis. It hurts so much. I hate it. And McCoy says, dialysis indeed. And he takes his little transponder and holds it up to her, and then opens it up and gives her a pill, says, here, take this. And later we go by that same woman, and she's, I'm cured. So, know, if we had a little transponder or something that we could use to just sort of poke at somebody and say, do they have kidney cancer or not? So, yeah.
Or here's their problem. Oh, we can fix that.
Exactly. So if we could do early diagnostics, we'd all be much better off.
That's for sure. Well, of course, we hope that's coming with all kinds of cancer, and with some cancers, that's almost here, where we can do very early detection, and we have the genetic information growing so fast, finding out things about mutations, either that occur in an individual or are passed down in the bloodline. We're learning so much that it's almost overwhelming how much we have to work with now, but we still are missing some of the basic points like the early diagnosis.
Yeah, one of the things that I talked about there was the history of what we've done with von Hippel-Lindau disease over the last 25 years, and we've learned so much. I remember clearly the first meeting that we had, the board meeting, when we first got the group of patients together in 1993, and we have learned more in the last 25 years than we ever imagined there was available that we could learn. So the knowledge is going up exponentially. Mike, you participated in a session called Controversies in Kidney Cancer. You want to share some thoughts from that one?
Well, you know, there is, as with all types of cancer and all types of medication, there are sometimes an abundance of theories and different positions that the medical community, as well as the patient community, takes on some topics. And there were four controversies that this panel addressed. And one of them was the role of active surveillance for watching small renal masses. You know, it's not only in kidney cancer that this is being done, but a lot of times the clinicians are finding out that perhaps a person that's diagnosed with cancer can have an excellent quality of life with little opportunity for that cancer to spread if we just leave it alone and watch it, and perhaps doing a minimal amount of invasive or therapeutic type treatment. And so there's a role for that in kidney cancer, but when somebody has been diagnosed and they find out they have a tumor, it almost requires that patient and that family to take on nerves of steel to be able to say, yes, we'll just let it sit there and we'll keep an eye on it from scan to scan and not do anything. But in many cases, that's the best course, because if you do surgery, a lot of times you can get it removed okay, but some people may struggle with having surgery because of some conditions
that
they have. So it submits them to unnecessary risk. Then another one, with kidney cancer, we're figuring out that if we can spare the nephrons and do a partial surgery versus taking out the entire kidney when there's a tumor located in it, that's a good thing.
Pause a second, Mike, and tell us about what nephrons are.
Well, I was going to.
Okay, thank you.
But the thing about it is, when a person loses an entire kidney, it didn't used to matter so much, because with kidney cancer, the recurrence rate was fairly high. There wasn't a whole lot of additional treatments that could be done, and so the person's not going to live very long anyway a lot of times. But now, since we have other treatments available, if we can remove a portion of that kidney, we preserve the function of that kidney that's left to be able to filter the urine and enhance our quality of life without having chronic kidney disease and possibly having to go into dialysis. So a partial nephrectomy is a good thing because those nephrons is what causes us to be able to process urine. When they removed my 20 years ago, we had a life expectancy of maybe 5 years. And so 15 years after that, when I should be dead, you know, I'm starting to have a higher creatinine level and go to the nephrologist, and she says, well, maybe at some point you're going to have to undergo dialysis for this. I said, okay, now when is that? She says, well, when you get 80 or 85, you're probably going to have to start doing dialysis. Oh, I should live so long, right?
Right. Yeah, we'll all
Well, definitely, plot. but you know, that's more than likely now, whereas in the past, as you said, living 5 years was good luck.
Well,
yeah,
and the surgical techniques and strategies have changed so much in the last 25 years. And it used to be that they said that the standard of care for kidney cancer was take out the kidney. And now we've learned really creative ways of preserving kidney function so that fewer and fewer people need dialysis from kidney cancer, I hasten to say, because more and more people need it from diabetes. So the total number of people on dialysis is going up, but from kidney cancer, it's considerably lower. So we need to continue on all ends of this argument, both the surgical and the drug management and diagnosis.
Yes, and being able to do a partial nephrectomy, of course, is a very advanced procedure, but in countries where dialysis isn't readily available, the importance of the partial nephrectomy becomes even greater.
Right. So, Robin, you participated in one session on treating young adults with kidney cancer, and there was also a session on dealing with kidney cancer in the elderly. Do you want to give us some perspective on those?
Well, kidney cancer in young adults is, of course, terrifying because nobody expects their child to have cancer and to have a life-threatening cancer. A lot is being done for childhood cancer, but unfortunately, if your child has renal cell carcinoma, it's still quite rare, which is good, it's rare, but it's very hard to treat because often it's an aggressive type of cancer and not terribly responsive to treatments. So Belinda Jago from Australia told us about her experience as the mother of a young woman who was diagnosed at about 14, I think, and had very serious problems with cancer for the rest of her life and died about 5 years later. And, of course, it was heart-wrenching, and people were reaching for Kleenex. But out of that, Belinda and her friends started a group to help parents and clinicians deal with childhood cancer and handle some of the problems that come up specifically with young people, like trying to stay in school, trying to stay active with their friends, not being tied to a hospital existence, not being invalids. And it was a very powerful presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Then for the elderly are a group of people who, especially with small kidney cancer or unknown masses in their kidneys, as long as they're small, this group can often benefit from active surveillance. And that really means keeping a very close eye on the situation and just making sure that nothing grows. And if it starts to grow, then dealing with it in whatever way seems best.
Right, because I think one of the things I've learned over the years is that basically surgery is not good for your health, okay? And if you are an elderly person with a whole bunch of other issues going on, you may not be a good candidate for surgery. We sign up for surgery by doing a cost-benefit analysis, and cost not just in money, but also in the toll it's going to take on the human being. So we elect to to put ourselves through several weeks of pain following surgery because we feel that the benefit, the long-term benefit, is going to be greater. In somebody who's older, that benefit analysis may not work out in the same way. The best thing might be not to do surgery. So, and we need to respect the wishes of the individual, too, as to whether or not
right.
they're ready and willing to do it.
Right, and all elderly people are not built the same way. I remember one person who came for advice and who said, I'm 80 years old and they're saying I shouldn't have surgery. He said, but if we sit and watch it for 10 years, he says, my family's very survival-oriented, and I expect to live at least until I'm 90, and I don't want to be told when I'm 90 that now I need surgery. I'd rather have the surgery now while
right.
I'm 80 and fit.
Right. Right. So there are many, many things that go into it, and we need to listen to the patient's voice as well, and people need to make an informed decision, not just an emotional decision, like, get this cancer out of me. No, that's not the whole story. We need to really look at what is the particular risk of this particular tumor. Is it likely to be a problem to you in the next 5 or 10 years or not? And if it's not, then we could make a saner decision, perhaps. As you say, doing the surgery or not doing the surgery, but for the right reasons.
Ladies, you know, it has been a fast episode today, and I know that we have just barely begun to scratch the surface of what we encountered during the 2018 IKCC convention. Do you have any words of wisdom that you would like to sum up with as we conclude this podcast?
Robin, you want to take it first?
I would like to tell people, if they happen to be listening to this from a country where they don't have a lot of patient participation in their own health care, that the International Kidney Cancer Coalition exists to help people start organizations to help kidney cancer patients get what they need, to give the patients a voice, to bring greater awareness to the cancer, to get better treatments, and everything that goes along with it. So if you're in a country where there's not much going on for kidney cancer, please get in touch with the IKCC if you need help.
Thank you. It's ikcc.org, and we'd be glad to hear from people in any country of the world who are dealing with kidney cancer. And I hope that those of you who are listening from the perspective of other conditions have found some useful tidbits amongst their conversation today. And I want to underscore the power of being together, just getting the patients together with the parents, the families, the physicians, the researchers, the drug developers. All of those groups need to be talking to one another and picking each other's brains, because each one of us has something very valuable to contribute. And you may not realize it yet, that you know that some things that could be helpful to a drug developer, but you do. And so the more we have those conversations, the faster we'll move things forward.
Thank you very much. Robin and Joyce, it's been a privilege to be your host today on Powerful Patient. This is Mike, and we'll have another podcast soon for you. Thank you for listening to us on The Powerful Patient.